Nightlife. Bite-sized history.
When Australia became a nation in 1901, it had no National Intelligence Service, really, or spy service, I suppose you would call it. The new government, though, quickly realised that its national interests were no longer always aligned with its role as part of the British Empire. So it set about protecting Australia's interests by spying. Spying on the Japanese, the Germans, the Chinese, and of course Britain itself. There's no doubt that these countries returned the favour. An experienced Australian spy himself, John Faes, told the story of how Australia built its own spy network. They were early adopters of radio technology, and the early operatives went on to dangerous missions, in some cases losing their lives, as they sought to protect Australia's interests. His new book is called Australia's First Spies. It's a comprehensive and, in many ways, thrilling story. And he joins us in the studio. John, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening. Nice to be here.
When it began in 1901, as I said, there were no spies, but the government quickly realised that it had interests which were not aligned with Britain's interests, and one of the early ones was New Caledonia. The French had planted a flag there in the middle of the 19th century and said, "This is ours," and there was concern about what was going on. It's a near neighbour. The British weren't interested at all, and then, in fact, were going to back the French, probably, if there was ever any issue anyway. The Australians decided they better do something about it, so they didn't have a spy, but one put up his hand. His name was Wilson Le Couteur, and tell us his story.
Well, Wilson was a man on the make from all I see in the documentation, and he volunteered his services as a spy for Australia, specifically to Edmund Barton, who he'd listened to speaking at the Sydney Town Hall in relation to the problems Australia faced in the New Hebrides. And Le Couteur was a Channel Islander, so he was fluent in both French and English. Mm-hmm. And he offered himself as the go-between. I also have a deep suspicion that Burns Foop and the Presbyterian Missionary Society was behind him as well, because they also had interests in the New Hebrides in holding back French influence. And Wilson put his hand up. But the important thing is that it was picked up almost immediately by Edmund Barton, with no hesitation whatsoever, and passed to his private secretary, a very significant player in the history of Australian intelligence, and that's Attlee Hunt, who pretty much dominated Australian intelligence collection from 1901 right through to around 1920, 21, when he was removed by Billy Hughes in a revamp.
Yeah, you're critical of Hughes, and you would join the long line of historians who are critical of Hughes for all sorts of reasons. But he did really, for the worst reasons, dismantle much of what Hunt had assembled, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Not just what Hunt had assembled, but what a lot of people have put a lot of effort into doing. He unraveled a system that was coming to maturity in 1919, and I think would have been a very significant system. Mm-hmm. But it was undone because Billy Hughes did not want anybody knowing more than he did on particular subjects, and he wanted to control the flow of information. So he cut the players off from that.
And it basically passed to the Navy. But let's get back to there in a moment. But up until the end of the First World War, there was a bit of a tradition of citizen spies. I mean, a bit like Wilson Le Couteur, wasn't there? Because there wasn't a paid service of intelligence officers, at least in the early days.
Well, the only people who were really running professional intelligence agencies were the Soviet... The Russians. Military intelligence... who we still see working today, one of the oldest intelligence systems in the world, and nowadays poisoning people in Salisbury. The first were the Russians, and certainly Britain was not far behind. But the tendency was towards the citizen spy, and it was because gentlemen, people with education and connections, had access.
Had the best way to get access.
So they automatically fell into the role of providing intelligence back to their governments.
There were some great daring do adventures, particularly during the First World War, on the outbreak of the First World War. Tell us about the capture of the German code books. There were a couple of ships, but They're ripping yarns.
The yarns themselves and the seizing of the ships where the Hobart was boarded as it came through
Port Phillip Heads,
and the officer in charge of the boarding party lay in wait in the captain's bunk until the captain came in to retrieve his code books from the secret compartment is a thrilling yarn. But it tends to hide the complexity of the operation, because this was a complexity that was planned well ahead of when it took place. Mm. And it was planned by the Admiralty in London in cooperation with the Australian Commonwealth Naval Board. And they'd come to the conclusion that with the declaration of war in Europe, it would be days before German vessels in the Pacific became aware that they were at war. And there was a window of opportunity to seize codebooks. And the codebooks seized off the Hobart are very famous, but the codebooks seized in West Australia are the most significant, because in those seizures, the Australian or naval intelligence operatives got control of both the German merchant marine codebooks, but also the Kriegsmarine. The entire German Navy codebooks were captured within days of the war being declared. And not only that, the way they were utilised, in that the codebooks themselves were a prize. They were property of a prize ship and couldn't be removed from the jurisdiction of a Supreme Court in the state. And as a consequence, people had to busily copy them out. So 40 or so copies were made to be sent back to London for use against the Germans in Europe. But not only that, the Admiralty was sending the entire captured German signals intelligence through the telegraph system to Australia, where it was being read, turned back into British codes and sent back to Britain. And so right from the very beginning of the war, the Royal Navy had access to German naval secrets that they continued right through to the end of the war. One of the interesting things that came out of that was that the Germans were so horrified by the exposure of this in the mid-1920s, they desperately sought out a way of encrypting their signals. And that's where the Enigma machine came from.
So
Australian successes in 1914 led to the creation of the Enigma machine in the mid-1920s.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, it is. But it comes back to this point that in looking at the history of Australian intelligence operations, people tend to overlook the significance of what we have done in this country and what our forefathers have done in this country.
Yes, indeed. Mm. I'm speaking with John Fay. He's written a book called Australia's First Spies. It's a comprehensive, wonderfully researched book about the history of Australian spying up until the end of the Second World War. Of course, after the First World War and through the 30s, the great security risk for Australia is Japan and its growing militarism.
Yeah.
Take us through the history of that, because we almost come from a standing start here, don't we? Initially, we think, well, we should all placate the Japanese with diplomacy and blah, blah, blah. Mm. That attitude changes.
I think if you're looking at it from a British perspective, yes, that's true. Mm. If you're looking at it from an Australian perspective, Australians were mightily suspicious even before the Commonwealth was formed. And there was a gentleman in North Queensland who was a volunteer member of the Queensland Navy, as it was at the time, and John Gillette Fernley. And he, amongst others, had identified what he regarded as suspicious behaviour by Japanese individuals. And it was typical naval intelligence. It was the collecting of data on how deep harbours were, what the rise and fall of the tide was, which way the winds blew, where you could get fresh water from, and so forth and so forth, which is normal naval activity. Every naval vessel that enters a harbour charts the harbour. That's its job. But the question was why? And one of the things that Fernley did was raised it with George Pearce, the West Australian senator, who was the Minister of Defence at the time. And he actually suggested that the establishment of an intelligence organisation of professional spies back in 1905. Mm. Now, the really significant problem was in around the 1900s, 1899, 1900, the expansion of the Japanese to the islands and their capacity to become a modern economy to some extent by that time. But with the Battle of Tsushima Strait, which is the greatest naval victory since Trafalgar, and in fact probably one of the most significant naval victories of the 20th century, including when you take into account things like the Battle of Midway and so forth. Tsushima was stunning. A Japanese fleet basically destroyed the entire Russian Navy, and they did it with the loss of a couple of motor torpedo boats and a small destroyer. So the impact of that on Australia, which was already markedly suspicious, and also had the problem that they faced of the White Australia policy, which alienated the Japanese. The Japanese were livid about the White Australia policy, and not because they didn't disagree with it. Behind the scenes,
they had their own.
Well, they had their own, and the deal that they were offering Australia, which later on Billy Hughes kiboshed, was that in return for Australia not including the Japanese amongst Asian peoples, which upset them something terribly, they would ensure no Japanese ever came to Australia. So you wouldn't need a White Australia policy to keep out Japanese, but don't list the Japanese amongst the Asians, because they didn't like that. So there was racism on both sides of the coin on that one. But the Japanese were facing very serious pressures in California. Australia came on board in 1901 with the Immigration Restriction Act. So we became of interest to the Japanese, and they were hostile towards us, but not alienated. The Tsushima 1905 changed the whole picture. From that point onwards, Japan was identified by Australian decision makers as the major threat to this country. And that continued right the whole way through to 1945.
How much in the 30s, how much did we know about, I mean, how effective was the spying operation in Japan?
The problem you faced with the Japanese was that their counterintelligence system, led by the Kempeitai, was, which is their military police, was superb. It was better than what the Germans ran. And you couldn't operate human intelligence assets in their areas of expertise.
Because they would expose and kill you.
Yeah, and they were very brutal about it. But they're all they're also very, very subtle. I mean, people don't realise that the Japanese Kempeitai ran a double cross system against Australia, using captured Australian operatives to send false messages back to Australia to bring in more parties for extermination. They'd even mapped our entire intelligence system, not including the SIGINT system, by 1945.
So they were well ahead of the game.
They were well ahead of the game. What we did do, though, very, very well, was map their signals intelligence.
This was a great achievement, wasn't it? The use of radio technology, and in a sense, what we would these days call electronic eavesdropping.
Yes.
Australians developed quite a capacity in this, didn't they?
And right from the very beginning. Right from the very beginning. And the reasons for it were practical. If you were trying to intercept radio waves in Europe from a high-frequency transmitter, you're in Britain and you're trying to intercept transmissions out of Europe itself, you're underneath what they call the sky wave. So that went above you. And you weren't within the lobes of what they call the ground wave, so you couldn't intercept it very well. But you could in Australia, because when the sky wave bounced off the ionosphere, it bounced back off the Earth and it bounced back off the ionosphere. And for a number of technical reasons, if you were at the Mornington racetrack in Victoria, you're in one of the best positions to pick up broadcasts from Berlin. And there were a couple of other spots in Australia that became very, very important from that perspective. So Australia became, for those reasons, very, very important player right from the beginning. And indeed, these days, if you go down to Mornington and you walk along the peninsula, you find little plaques in the ground marking where such and such a Royal Australian Navy telecommunications unit operated between 1914 and 1918, intercepting Skywave. And so Australia played from the very beginning. We also were very, very well positioned for the research into the effect of atmospherics in the tropics, because having possession of New Guinea and the seas around New Guinea, the Royal Australian Navy was able to do what we call the the mapping of the environment, what impact the thunderstorm activity had in that particular area. And it was very important work. And I believe, and the suspicion I have, and I haven't got hard proof, because I think that lies in the Burns Philp archive. But the indications are that they were mapping right from about 1913 using the Burns Philp vessel, the Matunga, which was then involved in its own interesting spy adventure in 1917.
You say it was dangerous running human assets in Japan. It was. I mean, there's you tell the story of Harry Freem in the case, went to an Australian spy who was most probably garrotted on a Tokyo street.
Yes. Look, I think the evidence it would indicate that the story that the family have held to for many, many years, and still do hold to, is that is true. And the thing that bothered me when I read through the files were the medical reports in which a diagnosis of gallbladder cancer was given as the cause of death. Yet when you looked at the medical reports that were done by the Japanese doctors, who had no reason to falsify them, there were no indications of any such problem with Harry Freem. And the other problem with gallbladder cancer is that, of course, you end up with the way you die is that you get secondaries in your liver and stomach. And there were no signs of secondaries in his liver or stomach when he was x-rayed. So the story of the fact that he got a death certificate which gave a completely false cause of death would indicate that, yes, he was strangled.
After the Coral Sea and Midway, of course, the naval threat to Australia is no longer present, if it ever really was. And there's much historical debate about what the Japanese intentions were about the northern part of Australia. A wholesale invasion, I think, was never planned, but there was clearly some intention to perhaps occupy strategic parts of northern Australia after. You're shaking your head.
No, I doubt that very much, because the only people who are more surprised at how far the Japanese got in 1942 were the Japanese. Yeah. They did not expect to get Malaya and Singapore as quickly as they did. They did not expect to be in Indonesia, and they did not expect to be in New Guinea. They were within their own general staff. There was a major debate about how far they should go and what they would do. Because what they wanted to really do was seize ground.
They did bomb significant. I mean, they bombed a large part of northern Australia, not just Darwin. A lot of people were killed.
The intelligence analysis right from the 1920s put forward by the chief staff in London was that the Japanese would conduct heavy raids on Australian ports. So they would attack ports like Darwin, Brisbane. They would attack ports like Sydney and maybe even Perth or Fremantle, I should say. And that held true. That intelligence assessment held true. And a lot of the history that's written about how we were let down type of thing, it overlooks the fact that when you read the actual assessments that were produced, they were absolutely accurate to the form of warfare that occurred. The Japanese, I don't think, had any intention of coming south. But if they could have seized Darwin without having to commit large forces, they would have probably done it as a bit of an adventure to see if they could hold it and use it as a negotiating tool in the peace settlement, which is what their strategic objective was to grab things and then negotiate in the way in return for a bigger area in Asia.
In Asia, Look, we could talk all night about this, and I would love to, but
we can't.
We can. It's a terrific book. It's called Australia's First Spies, The Remarkable Story of Australia's Intelligence Operations. One of the key points, I suppose, just in closing, that you make is that the mark of a nation, you say, is not always what it does publicly, but what it does privately.
Yes.
And you say, in that sense, Australia's intelligence operations were pretty firmly planted in protecting Australia's interests, whatever others might say.
Well, when you look back to the history of Australia, the starting premise for the book was why did men like Edmund Barton, Alfred Deakin, Henry Parkes, people who were major players in small colonial systems, why did they come together and form a commonwealth in which they all reduced their standing and power? And there had to be a payoff, because these were not individuals who did anything for nothing. And the payoff was to give them a say over the future of the region. And when you start to consider that perspective, the way they viewed Britain's behaviour in dealing with the Germans in Samoa and the Americans in Samoa. And now with the French in the New Hebrides, when Wilson Lacurtio went there and spied for us at great expense, you start to see that they were not men who were going to let Australia's self-interest be washed away by imperial interests.
No, as you say in the book, spying's always been expensive. Wilson Lacurtio, back in 1901, was charging them $15,000 a week.
Yes, yes.
So it's spying has always been a bit expensive.
It's always been expensive, and it always will be expensive.
Great to talk with you, John.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.